creation.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Hundreds of people every night now need free meals in Bristol. We talked to Alan Goddard, who helps provide them. Plus, Central Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan and the Middle East. Are we only there after oil and gas, or is it drugs as well? When will we have to pull out? We hear from Iranian channel Press TV, now banned here in Britain by the broadcasting regulator Ofcom. Plus, continuing on from last week, an insight into African and Somali politics, as we hear from Omar Farouk Osman, the president of the Federation of African Journalists. Plus, Martin Summers' weekly tour of the world's hotspots. But first this week, I'm joined by Alan Goddard, who's the drop-in manager at the Wild Goose. Hi, Alan. Welcome to Drive Time.
Evening to you.
Now, what about the Wild Goose? Tell us a little bit about it. Where is it and how did it start?
It's in Stapleton Road. It started around 27 years ago by...
Hang on, because Stapleton Road's quite long, isn't it?
It certainly is. So it's Old Market End, so near the police station off her. Started 27 years ago, and we moved to Stapleton Road just about 2 years ago.
Okay, give us an idea of what sort of facilities you've got there.
Be all nice. We feed about 500 people a day. That's probably around 100, 120,000 a year meals. We offer careers advice. We have a nurse in. We have a doctor in. We have citizens advice bureau. Dozens and dozens of different types of organisations trying to help people promote independence.
Now, 500 people, feeding 500 is quite a lot of people. But how does that work? Is it over a long period of time? Have you got a lot of space? It sounds like basically the size of some sort of kind of university refectory you would need.
It sounds like it. We open at 10 o'clock in the morning until 3. We close again, and then we open at 8 o'clock tonight, and we close at 10, and we do that 6 days a week. And it's spread over that period of time that we feed between 400 and 500.
Now, give us an idea of how things have changed over the last few years. I mean, I'm sure when you first opened, decades ago, you weren't feeding 500 people in a day.
Probably maybe 20 years ago, we were feeding maybe 50, 60 people a day, something like that. But over the years, as you can imagine, with the drug culture taking over and alcohol problems, you know, what's happened is more people have dropped into addiction, more people have found themselves homeless, and it's just escalated, and it's going to get even worse than what it is now.
Oh, so you're talking about addiction and homelessness. Are those the two main causes that people have to come there?
Prostitution is a huge problem which is not about to go away for some time.
What sort of food are you actually providing? Is it just one course? If someone, say I was to turn up at 8 o'clock, would I have to wait a long time to eat? And what would I get at the end?
There might be a queue of 80 people outside tonight if you could turn up at 8 o'clock-ish. To give you an example, if you turned up tomorrow morning, you could have cereal, toast, yoghurt, orange juice, tea, coffee. Wouldn't cost you a penny. If you were to cook breakfast, it would cost you £1.50. Lunch is free. Evening meal is free. The only thing we charge for is for breakfast, and we lose money on that, actually.
For a cooked breakfast?
That's correct.
Okay. Whereabouts does the food come from that you get? Do you get sort of out-of-date food from supermarkets, that kind of thing?
We never use out-of-date food. All our food is high quality. A lot comes from Fair Share. A lot comes from other areas which we source food. We buy a lot. But the reason we give free food, in case people are wondering, is the fact that probably 98% of our clients, customers, have a lot of problems. They might be mental health, they might be prostitution, addiction, whatever. And what we do, we provide good quality free food to build a relationship with them. So we use a person-centered approach, and by getting to know them over a period of time, then when they're ready to change, we're ready to help them.
And how many people would you think that you are actually able to help? Because some people just want to come along for the food. They don't actually really want someone telling them how to behave.
Well, I'll have to disagree on that one, because I'll be frank with you, the majority of people which we have in, eventually we help. And that might be in a number of ways. That might be they have debt problems and they can't afford to buy food. That might be they're not budgeting. So we actually get them on their life skills and we learn them to budget, we learn them to cook, anger management. If they got drug addictions, we arrange a detox. If they got alcohol addictions, we arrange a detox. Put them into rehab, community living. We try and provide what they want to move into.
Now, it sounds pretty hairy, Alan. I don't know if I would like to sit down with people with detox problems and anger management problems over a meal. I might get indigestion.
Well, you're talking to someone who was in addiction 18 years. I was an alcoholic. I was a drug addict. I lived on the streets for 11 months.
Well, when you say a drug addict, what were you addicted to?
I was addicted to Downers, Librium, Cocodamol, Valium, Diazepam, anything which makes me sleep. Just like a bit like heroin, but you use it in a different way.
And do you find that there's a lot of difference between different types of addiction, different drugs? Obviously, heroin is quite a big one.
Yeah, but there's lots of other ones which are taken over, like MCAT and horse tranquilizer. There's some really nasty drugs out there now.
And why do people, it might sound an obvious question, but why do people take these drugs? Because obviously they're costing them money and potentially, anyway, doing them harm.
Cope with life. You know, some people have really demanding jobs. You've seen on the television last night where you had all these squatters. You know, if you looked around and you listened to them, they were very, very well-educated squatters. They were people who could talk well. They were backwards. And this is why one of our bigger things is going to schools, is to really give good education to youngsters, because the youngsters are the ones who've actually got the money to buy the drugs. As very often their parents have got such demanding jobs, they don't give their time to their children. They're 15, 16-year-olds, they give them money instead. What do? They try smoking, they try drinking. And before long, between the arguments and the breakdown of relationships between parents and a child, at 15, 16, they're walking out of the door.
So what sort of philosophy governs what you do? And I suppose the obvious big question is, which goes with it, I suppose, is whereabouts does the money come for you to actually do this?
We need £300,000 a year to exist. And 99.9% of that money comes from donations who like the work we do. Now, we're a Christian organisation. We're proud of that because we stand really firm on our belief as Christians. But at the same time, we're not there to judge people, whether they're Muslim or whatever they are. We're there to help them. You know, quite recently, I've been helping a Jehovah's Witness family who the daughter slipped into alcohol addiction. That woman's been sober now 3 months. So for us, it's really actually about working with whatever's in front of us, regardless of what.
Now, of course, some people will say, well, you're only providing the food because you want to convert us to your religion.
Well, they can say what they like, but that's totally not true.
Well, how do you prove that?
I don't have to prove it. If you want to come into my centre tomorrow, I'll feed you. If you said to me, you know, why do you do this? I might share my faith. I can be honest about that. But the reason...
Well, do that now. Why do you do it?
I do it because I believe actually God called me to do it. If you want the story, I was living on the streets really rough in a real mess. I had hair out here. I'd been sectioned 7 times. 2 Christians came along and said to me, Alan, I think you need to change your life. Do you want the truth? I told them where to go. Really sharp. I used very strong language. But they kept on and kept on and kept on. And eventually I thought, you know, they're not really after anything. And all they were concerned about was me. And they helped me get into a rehab. I went to a Christian rehab. I was there 11 months. Now, I've been used to earning £120,000 a year. Money don't motivate me anymore. What I believe is God came into my life in a very special way, just like a Muslim, what they believe in. And I really respect all of religions, and I'm not trying to change one religion to another. I'm there because I believe God brought me to Eastern.
Well, surely that's not God. That's just two people coming along and seeing you and caring for you.
God's using two people.
Okay. Martin Summers. Now, before we go back to Martin Summers, you're saying that things are getting worse.
Yeah.
What makes you say that, Alan?
Well, the quantity of people we're feeding, the different type of people is coming to our centre. So, you know, we're seeing people coming there with children who are really struggling and really generally struggling. You know, they're coming in where their benefits have been stopped because of the way things are changing. You know, very shortly, if you're over 34 years of age, you won't be able to claim full housing benefits. So it means if you're any sort of age, from 34 down, it means for the council to give you under £75 a week for your housing. Now, the amount of people unemployed at the moment in Bristol is astronomical, and in this country. So it means you're not going to get your own flat. You're going to struggle to get a room. So lo and behold, you know, it's going to get worse.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, this is pretty worrying, certainly from what the Chancellor has been saying about benefit caps of various sorts, things like the bedroom tax, making sure that benefits aren't actually even going up in line with inflation. So we're going to end up with people that maybe, you know, can't afford to buy things, basic things like toilet rolls, whilst we've got bankers running away with multi-million pound bonuses. This isn't looking all that good, is it, for as a social consequence of some of the big decisions being made up in London?
Well, that's true, and obviously, you know, there's a squeeze on people's incomes, especially at the bottom end and so on. But picking up on what's been said about addiction and family breakup and so on, if you have a mass unemployment society for a very long period, I mean, there's been about a million unemployed at least throughout my adult lifetime, and I'm 53. You then develop a kind of culture of unemployment, a culture of addiction. You know, people used to leave home, go and work in the local factory. It was pretty boring, but they knew what they were doing. There was a very stable life path for people. But if you think of young people now, even people leaving university with massive debts and no job on easily found. And of course, then of course people start making it up. They experiment with all the different drugs that are around. As you know, there's more drugs around than ever. And ultimately we then end up with a kind of flotsam and jetsam of society where people are basically just being thrown out of the social system and then just left to rot.
Martin, what you seem to be saying here is that one of the side effects of actually having a faltering economy is that ordinary people are being driven into the black economy, into the into the black market, and actually starting to find that maybe a criminal organised crime gang can offer them work where they can't get work through the job centre.
I think that's possible, but one thing I would say is more youngsters fall into addiction than later in life.
Yeah, and they're very vulnerable at that. They're very vulnerable at that age, aren't they?
A bit later. You know, the one thing I'm aware of is the fact that, you know, we're approaching probably 5-10 years and we are going to have an epidemic of alcohol-related problems, which is going to hit this country so hard. They've got no idea how hard that's going to be.
What makes you think say that? Because of the youngsters?
One alcohol detox bed in Bristol. The whole of Bristol. Mm. If you imagine the whole of Bristol, one alcohol detox bed. So when someone wants, if just say you wanted a detox, you might have to wait 2-3 years.
So why is that? I mean, can't you as an organisation help provide that sort of thing?
We've done 35 detoxes. In fact, I just finished one today. So we actually oversee a detox. So it means that I pick up a person, 7 o'clock in the morning. I go to the doctor's room first. I check what the condition of the patient is in. Has he got high blood pressure? Has he got a fit? Does he hallucinate? All them sorts of things. If he has, we can't touch him. He's got to go to hospital because he could hemorrhage when he's detoxing. Now, for us, what we do, if the person is reasonably fit, reasonably normal, then what we can do, we can negotiate an amount of Librium, maybe 40 milligrams four times a day or 30 milligrams four times a day, reducing. We do have 12 days, and last year we'd done about 35, probably more in the local authority, in hospital.
How many homeless people actually are there? I mean, the Bristol area is about 350,000 people. How many of those are homeless?
I think if you were to talk to Bristol City Council, they'd probably tell you 7 or 8.
What the official figure is about 14,000.
Oh, that's gone up then, that's good. Do you know what determines a homeless person? They have to be lying down in their sleeping bag or their blanket lying over the top of them. If they're standing up, they're not classed as a homeless person. So in Bristol at the moment, we've probably got somewhere in the region between 50 to 70 people living on the streets in car parks, under hedgerows.
But now, I remember the last council figures for that were something like 7 or 8. So how come they get their figures so wrong?
Well, I think if you went to the council now and said that you're homeless, they'd assess you and say, well, come back next week for your assessment. And this is why I say is if we've only got these few amount of homeless people in Bristol, why do you have to wait such a long time for an assessment at maybe Amelia Court? Whereas, yes, you'll get one at St Mungo's, and they do a very good job at St Mungo's, but to get a proper assessment, then you'll have to go to Amelia Court. And, you know, there is obviously an awful lot more problems as people fall out of accommodation, but it's a huge problem. It's not going to go away.
I noticed, I think it's Cumberland Street, round the back of the Bear Pit, actually, used to be the place called The Hub. In fact, annoyingly, there are still signs up around town saying, if you're homeless, follow this sign. Yeah. And then when you get there, the whole place is boarded up.
And what's sad, you know, I mean, that's a council property. which the taxpayer is paying
for. Actually, I don't think so. I think it's private property. The council were renting. But Cumberland Street is an unbelievable street. If you look down the street, you can see one side of it. The entire street is boarded up with shuttering and panelling. That's about something like nine or ten houses worth of offices all the way down. The entire side of Cumberland Street is just boarded up. It is. Anyway, since you saw the squatting programme last night, what were your thoughts about that? Do you think it was a fair reflection of what goes on?
You know, I thought they were living very well. I've been in lots of the squats in Bristol. At the end of the day, you know, most people don't want to live in pigsties, so in general, most squatters would look after their place. But I have to say, I don't agree with squatting. I really don't, and I know I'm going to make a few enemies by saying that, but at the end of the day, I believe that the council, local authorities ought to provide enough housing for people to live if they want to live some. But a lot of squatters also choose that lifestyle. So, you know, even if you were to offer them a place, some wouldn't take it.
Interesting. Okay, so you tell us a bit about your, funders. You said 99% of your money comes from donations. Is this rattling tins or going to trusts and that kind
of
thing?
All sorts of things.
And churches. I imagine if you're a Christian organisation, you've got, hang on a minute, the Catholic Church have got a bit of gold and silver, haven't they?
Well, that's what everyone thinks, but in reality, the church is not as rich as what it seems. And what I say to you, lots and lots of churches support us very generously, very generously. And yes, we apply for different trusts, and we're very successful in doing that because we have such a good reputation. Quite recently, we won the Queen's Award. So, you know, obviously everyone thinks we're doing a good idea.
Did she come down and have a meal then, when she was in Bristol the other week?
Well, we've actually invited Prince Charles, and you never know, he might come, who knows. But also we believe in earning our own money. We opened the shop in Clevedon, which is where I live. We opened a very big shop, which has been open now 2 years, doing fantastic, which is a second-hand furniture shop. And quite recently, an organisation called Love Bristol have opened something called Habitat, which is also...
Hang on. Happy Tat.
That's it.
Happytat. Happytat.org is the website. Yep, everything's on the web these days. But what is it?
Well, it's a second-hand charity shop. It's a charity shop which sells second-hand furniture and items. It's the open day tomorrow, but it's been open about 10 days. It's doing really, really well. If people want to donate furniture, all they have to do is have a look on the website.
They can go along to Croft House on Stokes Croft. Where is that on Stokes Croft?
Just by the bear pit, so it's just going up towards Stokes Croft, and it's the first shop on the left hand side.
So that's Happytat, a community enterprise generating income for charity through the sale, recycling and upcycling of donated... what is upcycling?
Upcycling is when you get an old piece of furniture and you change it. So it might be where you take all the varnish off and you might repaint it, you might stencil it, and I gotta say, some pieces look so different and so nice.
Well, I don't know if I would necessarily want them in my living room, Alan. Also, you run a food bank. Tell us about that, because that's, you know, that's one of the things that we keep hearing about being springing up right across the country. Many people of them who do have jobs having to come to those food banks to get food for the week.
It's tough when you lose your job, and you very often don't think you'll end up going to a food bank, but in reality, an awful lot of people do. And we run one now in Easton, which has been going about 18 months. It's very...
So where is that in Easton?
In St. Mark's Road, in St. Mark's Church. So it's open on Friday afternoons. And if you can prove that you've lost your job or your benefits have been stopped, you can do that by going to the job centre. They'll give you a letter, and then they'll also give you a voucher, and you bring the voucher down, and then we actually provide you with food for the quantity of people in your family.
Now, there was a programme on the telly maybe a month or so ago about the food banks. It was quite clear there were some people turning up there who managed to scam these little vouchers and were not in any way poor, in fact had quite nice cars and things like that. Surely there are some people like that turning up who are just scamming food off you.
Can I say they're scamming in all walks of life? They were scamming when all the ministers were taking money out of putting false claims in. At the end of the day, that's all was going to happen. But the most important thing was this food bank is there to meet the people really in need, and that's why they have to provide a letter from the DHSS or from the job centre to say that their benefits have been stopped or they're unemployed.
Alan, you mentioned briefly about going into schools. What do you do when you're going into your schools?
Well, we talk, you know, we're not against people drinking, You know, because even though I'm an alcoholic, I really do believe social drinking, there's nothing wrong with it, you know, as long as you do it properly. And really for us is to talk to youngsters. I like to have a school of a classroom of 30. Next week I'm in St. Mary Redcliffe talking to 500 children, 2 days running. I think I've gone to 40 schools this year. I'd like to double it this year, if I can, this coming year.
So what's your message?
Our message is about, you know, drugs will kill you. But we do in a different way to that.
But they won't, will they? Because quite a lot of people have small amounts of drugs and they don't kill them. So you're just scaremongering there.
Can I say to you, if you take MCAT, you take the, maybe one or two of the other drugs, you won't last long. First of all, your kidneys will go, your bladder will go. There's people that are out now, 16, 17 years of age, where their bladder taken away. At the end of the day, drugs will kill you.
But alcohol's a drug. I mean, why is it that some of these drugs are legal and some aren't? I mean, we had quite an interesting discussion with Richard Branson and Peter Hitchens on Channel 4 News last night on this topic, because they're saying we're losing the war on drugs. So the best thing to do is to actually decriminalise a lot of these drugs. I mean, is that something you'd agree with?
I don't know. I've thought about that a great deal. The one thing I would say to you, if they were to invent alcohol now, and you think of whiskey at 40%, that would be a Class A drug. Because you drink it, and in 15 minutes, you could be paralytic.
And tobacco as well is very damaging.
Yeah. But what I'd say is legalising drugs, what we would find also is we might suddenly find an awful lot of people more on the state than we are now. Because they'd be trying something to see what it's like, because it's legal. And then the next year, you know, instead of a million on the dole, if that's what we have, we might have 3 million on the dole. I have to say, I'm not sure.
Martin Summers, you've talked about this quite a bit here, actually arguing the case to a certain extent for decriminalisation of drugs, the war on drugs having been supposedly lost. I mean, trying to actually get the drug cartels. We're going to be talking about that a little bit later with what's going on in Afghanistan, because that's one of the biggest producers of heroin in the world. Martin.
Yeah, I think you've got to distinguish decriminalisation. In Portugal, they decriminalised drugs about 10 years ago now, and in actual fact, all the studies show that the level of drug use is as bad as it was. It's not worse. It's as bad as it, you know. As you know, being an ex-user yourself, if you really are determined to get out of your head, there is plenty of ways to do it, and it's and there always will be. It's a question of having the self-esteem and the common sense to not. I mean, some of the things you're talking about, MCAT or whatever. I mean, really. They need to hear that the youngsters need to hear, look, whatever you do, don't do this stuff, and the information they should get is it should be accurate and clear. I mean, you know, smoking a cigarette or a joint is not the same as injecting heroin or drinking yourself to death. But on the other hand, we shouldn't be encouraging people to take drugs. There shouldn't be advertising for drugs. There should be a health message very strongly given to people that this is bad for you. But the problem with having it is illegal is that we've now got criminal drug cartels with massive amounts of cash, bailing out banks, buying governments, and
actually,
and so
actually,
on. And at some point,
actually,
that's got to be.
Can
so
I just put just
that.
Come in there, because Lord can Green, who's a government minister, was in charge of HSBC when he was warned by the Americans that the Mexican drug cartels were using his armoured vans from HSBC to run their cash around. So he was basically a treasurer for a Mexican drug cartel, and he's still a government minister.
And on top of what you're saying, I think, you know, if you think about methadone, which has been around now for quite a number of years, which is a drug which is similar to heroin to a degree. It's a sort of hold you. But what I say is an awful lot of methadone users have now switched to alcohol. So now they've got an alcohol addiction and a methadone addiction. You know, so what I'm saying is, even if we were to legalise heroin, you might suddenly have alcoholics and heroin. So
alcohol is under recognised as a threat, because it has been a socially acceptable drug for thousands of years, unlike some of the new stuff.
But Martin,
which is why we've only got one
bed of money for.
Oh yes, which is why we've only got one detox bed for alcohol, whereas the sexier drugs have got more interest taken in them.
Well, you only got one detox bed because we haven't got the money to open any others. We could have opened one last year, but instead we actually employed an extra two nurses at the BRI to assess people rather than to put them in.
Yeah.
The one thing I'd say, I'm fully up to date with, you know, way it all works, and the one thing I'm totally and utterly convinced of, no question about it, we need to recognise that it's going to get 10 times worse.
I think that's right, because I think the world economy is in a very, very bad state. And, of course, the drug cartels and the governments have actually bailed out the banking system. There's a UN report on drugs and crime, which came out a couple of years ago, and it said, well, what happened in 2008 when the banks were wobbling? The drug cartels went to the banks, said, you're having a panic, you need some money, we've got some. And all the money was sucked into the banking system that had been hanging around for ages. Mm. Now, we don't see the money moving around. We see the drugs and we see the effect of the drugs on the streets. But the money moving around has actually been so... I mean, the drugs industry now is probably bigger than, say, the car industry. And don't forget, there's no tax involved. There's no regulation. And the this money is now completely corrupting things like the Mexican election. It looks like the guy who's won is in the pocket of the drug cartels, and he would be, because they need money and so on. But I think, ultimately, we need a health message to people. You can't stop people, legal or illegal. People are going to go out and take drugs of one kind or another. They always have. I can't see there's going to be any change in that. And we need to give people hope and a future and you know, family life and all those things that people need to make them have a decent lifestyle, so that they won't want to get out of their heads all the time because they're feeling miserable.
Well, I rather love what you're saying, Alan, about the potential problems in the future. What you're being, in a way, is a watchman here on the watchtower, saying, hang on, guys, this army of hell is coming over the horizon. Yeah. We've got to be ready for
it.
It's
going to cost millions. I think this is, they're not putting enough money into alcohol rehabilitation. You know, it's being cut every single year. Mm. The reason for that, really quickly, is I know there's not a lot of time, but you know, in the southwest, in this area, we did have 10% of the country's rehabilitations in this area, for the whole of the country. Yes, it's reduced a bit now, there's a few have closed, but what I'm trying to say is loads and loads and loads of addicts for years and years and years have come down to the southwest to do a rehabilitation. Some have succeeded, a lot have failed. The ones who failed normally stay. Over the last 10 years, we haven't sent that many people out of the area because we've already got the rehabs in here. And our pocket of addicts in Bristol is getting bigger and bigger and bigger every year.
Well, I don't want to be the merchant of doom, but I can remember also that Clive Smith, the filmmaker from St Paul's, who made a couple of films for the BBC back about 7 or 8 years ago, fantastic guy. He was filming various addicts in the parks around St Paul's and chatting with them, you know, trying to get them to talk. And they were saying, well, we come to Bristol because the heroin's so cheap here.
And so good. It's been cut right. Addicts will go to a place where they know they're going to get heroin, which haven't been mixed with Rim or some sort of thing.
In Merseyside in the 80s, Dr. John Marks was prescribing heroin to his clients, and of course they were getting proper heroin from the doctor. And in actual fact, then they don't have to deal, they don't have to steal. It's a personal problem for them, it's not a problem for the rest of the society.
But if we do that in this country, we legalise it, they'll probably tax it, and we'll end up then with another big tax, which we'll pay for. Because
like tobacco duty or something.
When Britain controlled Hong Kong in the early part of this century, everybody was using heroin because, don't forget, the British had got control in China by selling them heroin, and they used to tax it was legal to get heroin in Hong Kong, but the government would tax it to such a level that it wasn't quite worth smuggling it. Yeah. But it's still what we do. Why do we have tax on alcohol? We try and make it more expensive. So they're talking now about making each unit
I'm not 40p. Sure I agree with that. I'm not convinced that actually putting up the price of alcohol so the government can make more money, it's going to affect the person who likes the odd pint every couple of weeks. It won't affect the alcoholic now at all, but it might just affect the alcoholic in 10 years' time, who might consider maybe not buying extra bottle of wine this week because you think, oh, it's a little bit dear, we'll have it this week, and you won't slip into it.
Well, I think what's really important is that we should have an adult conversation about all of these things, rather than everybody screaming and shouting, oh, no, you're talking about legalising drugs, that's so... Let's have an adult conversation about it. Let's have an adult conversation, because we know very well that plenty of people who are not doing illegal drugs go home, drink themselves to destruction, are destroying their family. But it's not legal, it's not illegal, but it's just as destructive.
And the antisocial behaviour causes the police.
Yes.
I think it's the bigger picture of
exactly.
It all.
Exactly, so we need an adult conversation about all of this, starting at the younger stage with our children.
I seem to remember Professor Nutt was saying this is a few years ago now, as the head of the committee that decides these things up in Westminster, was said a few things about cannabis, saying, oh, well, actually cannabis should be downgraded and it's not actually so damaging, and he was sacked for his trouble, wasn't he?
But you see, cannabis, when it was cannabis. It was probably just a little bit worse maybe when a cigarette. But the stuff they sell now, skunk, that really cracks your head up. I got a couple of young lads come into my place who smoke skunk on a regular basis, and it brings out all the anxiety in you, it brings all the paranoia in you, and you're practically a walking vegetable. Now, I don't say everyone goes that way, but an awful lot do.
But I think one of the problems is with skunk in particular, it's like potting or drinking distilled whiskey or something. Yeah, it's not like, you know, drinking a half pint of mild in the pub. It's like going and knocking your head off with a bottle of vodka. Yeah. And of course, the youngsters are getting involved in all this drug scene, and they're actually not being educated about what drugs are and what they actually do, because there's other kinds of cannabis, as you know, which aren't as strong as skunk.
Okay, I'd just like you to wind up, Alan. It's been fascinating hearing from you. To just remind us whereabouts you are and what times you're opening is, if people actually need something to eat, because there are obviously, as you said, increasing numbers of people out there vulnerable, trouble in their life, that, you know, some just simply poor, that need somewhere to eat. So where are you and where?
We're in number 32 Stapleton Road, which is more or less opposite of Leisure Centre, but a bit further down on the opposite side. We're open at 10 o'clock in the morning, and we stop serving hot food at 2. But you can have cake and tea, coffee up until 3. And then in the evening we open at 8 o'clock and we stop serving food at 9:45.
And so from our council tax, from Bristol City Council, how much funding do you get?
None at all. Well, and I wouldn't even take it. If I had my way in my organisation, I'd never take government funding.
Why is that?
Because there are too many strings attached to it. They always want statistics, they always want figures. And in reality, you and this gentleman, you are not the same. We have to treat people as individuals. If you try and treat everyone the same, you will not succeed. You have to try and to achieve what that individual needs, not what you think it needs.
Well, Alan Goddard, who's the drop-in manager at the Wild Goose at Stapleton Road, thanks very much for joining us.
God bless you. Thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, back to the horrid reality of the banking crisis, which once that's sorted out, of course, people like Alan will be able to go their way, because everyone will have plenty of food and plenty of jobs. Martin, I come back to this, the couple of articles we mentioned briefly last week about the appointment of the new Bank of England governor, Mark Carney. He will be coming to place, I think it's April next year, he takes his job over from Mervyn King. Mervyn has said some stuff over the last 10 days or so, which implies that the effect of the financial crisis on incomes in Britain is the equivalent of a world war. He's actually comparing it to the Second World War, to when the Second World War started, the sort of effects that it had on people's incomes and people's private finances is an equivalent of what's happening today.
Yes, and don't forget that we're actually only at the beginning of the crisis. Like, you hear people on the radio and the television, like Andrew Neil, the other way, saying, "And as the recovery takes hold, what is the choices facing Britain?" There is no recovery taking hold. We're teetering on the brink of catastrophe here, not just in Britain. In the whole global economy has been mismanaged for years by neoliberal bankers and their acolytes in the political class, and basically I fear that we're going to have a social convulsion of enormous proportions, which will then have lots of fallout for people like Alan, who are dealing with the detritus which will be created.
Yeah, we mentioned the Bilderberg group last week as well, which is something that I've got a website on, bilderberg.org, and I've been researching them for really about the last 15 years. This group was started by a former SS officer in the German army. He was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. He was when he was at university, he was also a member of the Nazi party, which he lied about later on in most of his life, which has now been discovered by Dutch journalists in Dutch, so it's quite difficult to find that stuff in English. But yeah, he was a Nazi when he was at university, Bernhard, and he was the chairman of the Bilderberg group until 1975. Now this guy Mark Carney has been along to the last two Bilderberg meetings, and also there was a Bilderberg meeting, another one, 2-3 weeks ago in Rome, just before the announcement that he was going to be taking over. Do you think there's actually any problem with these think tanks like this? I mean, I've painted it as a sort of, you know, at least some sort of Nazi influence on the organisation when it was first started in the 1950s, with this ex-Nazi being the chairman until 1975. The reason that Bernhard had to leave was because he was embroiled in the Lockheed scandal, where he was found to have taken a bribe of $1 million to get the Dutch government to buy the Starfighter aircraft, and he was replaced by Lord Peter Carrington. But this organisation, I mean, is it okay? Do you think are they to be trusted for him to be part of it? Because obviously George Osborne, who's selected Carney, is also a Bilderberger, as is Ed Balls as well. They go to these private meetings too.
Well, it wouldn't be surprising if the movers and shakers on the planet decided to get together once in a while to fix things, and Bilderberg is one of the forums in which they do this. What's also interesting about Carney and various other people who are now being running various European countries like Mario Draghi is they all used to work for Goldman Sachs, which is an individual private company. So we're not even talking about the Bilderberg group, which has got some kind of public interest justification. You know, we're getting the movers and shakers together to have a chat. Goldman Sachs is basically money machine for those on the inside.
But
Carney
was
one of them.
Hang on a minute, because wasn't it Goldman Sachs that kind of caused the problem in the first place? These investment banks were at the heart of the financial crisis, in the cause of it, and they were being told, oh, here's a guy from Goldman Sachs, he can fix it all up.
Exactly. I mean, if we'd followed the free market policy of not bailing out the banks, and Goldman Sachs is classified as a bank for bailout purposes, even though it's actually a hedge fund and doesn't take any deposits, they were so politically powerful that they were able to get themselves classified as a bank so that they could be bailed out. And then these are the people who caused the crisis, who are now presenting themselves as the solution to the crisis that they've called. And of course, that they've caused. Now, in actual fact, none of these people are the solution. They're all pushing this austerity line, which simply won't work. And very soon, the austerity line will fail. The banks will probably fail. National and local governments will fail as a result, because they will lose revenue and end up paying out more in benefits and so on. And at that point, we'll start to realise that in actual fact, neoliberal capitalism is finished. It died about 4 years ago, but people are still deluding themselves that we are going back to normal with a private banking system, God in his heaven, and everybody getting back.
Well, why don't our governments intervene? I mean, the government owns Lloyd's and Royal Bank of Scotland. Why on earth don't the government intervene and say, because and start telling these
because
people
the philosophy
how to behave?
The philosophy is that the banks should be managed at arm's length, because ultimately we're going to have private banking back. And therefore, the government shouldn't intervene in decisions made by private bankers, because otherwise that will interfere with their profitability and their goals, and ultimately we won't be able to sell them back to the private sector and get the money back that we've wasted on them. Now, in actual fact, ultimately, people are going to realise that the private financial markets are finished. They didn't have to be finished. If they'd been properly managed and regulated, they could continue to exist. But the fact is that from the deregulation of the City of London in the mid-80s, we've now set ourselves up for a massive failure, and it's the failure of the Conservative government of that era, the failure of Labour governments subsequently. But the fact is that this is now going to fail. The private financial system is finished. Now, what we have to put in place is a public financial system which is run as a public utility. Now, we're making that argument, but still the mainstreamers, the Bilderbergers, the Goldman Sachs people, the mainstream media, oh no, what are you talking about? We're going to have private banks, we're going back to having a private banking setup. Once the crisis is over, all the banks will be private again as they were before. Rubbish. They won't. They're never going to be. There is never going to be a private banking system of the kind that existed before the crash. Ultimately, there will probably be a public banking system managed by the state or by the local authorities. That's where we're going to go in the end, but there's going to be an awful lot of screaming and crying before we get there.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
And Morsi says, in Egypt, I won't tolerate anyone working to overthrow a legitimate government. Well, he's decreed that basically that his local judicial system has no jurisdiction over him at all. And as a result, fire bombs at the headquarters of the Muslim Brotherhood. Not looking good in Egypt, Martin.
Well, I think the Muslim Brotherhood firebombed the opposition, wasn't it? Was it not? Was it the opposition that firebombed the Muslim Brotherhood? I think the problem is that you've got two major blocks in Egyptian politics, the sort of secular bloc and the Muslim Brotherhood.
Can I just make that clear? Several thousand anti-government protesters stormed the headquarters of the Muslim Brotherhood, breaking windows and furniture and setting the building on fire.
Right, well, I mean, what we've got there is conflict between two major blocs in democratic, if you like, Egyptian politics.
But I mean, you know, they're saying they don't want a king. They want someone who's accountable to the rule of law.
Yes, and I think that they're worried that Morsi's making a kind of power grab, a bit like Napoleon or whatever. Morsi says, well, actually, I won the election, and therefore I'm entitled to make steps I need to make, and I've got to get rid of the previous regime's hardliners who are still in place, and so on. It's very hard to read from a distance. One would hope that both sides will step back and realise that there's got to be some democratic agreement to make a democratic system work. I read various reports on the internet that Morsi didn't in fact win the election, that he was gifted the election by the army because they wanted him to win, because that, in that way, if the previous regime's candidate had won, the more secular candidate, then that would have caused the Muslim Brotherhood to kick off. So the easiest thing to do was to let them win. Now, I don't know whether that's true, but those are the kind of suspicions that you'll find on the street.
Martin, it sounds like utter turmoil in Egypt. No sort of Arab Spring with people smiling afterwards, is it?
No, because of course we've got a major economic crisis which provoked the Arab Spring in the first place, and people don't get enough to eat every day, and that makes them angry.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
And Syria is slamming NATO and their plans to deploy Patriot missiles. A Turkish move and NATO's support for it is a provocative move, part of psychological warfare against Syria, apparently. Damascus has heaped scorn on NATO for its planned deployment of the Patriot missiles along the border with Turkey, calling it a provocative move. Well, is it, Martin?
I think it is. And also all of this stuff we've been hearing in the media this week about Assad is going to use chemical weapons on his own people. I don't think there's a shred of evidence.
I don't think.
That.
I mean, there was also a video, wasn't there, put out supposedly by the Syrian rebels saying, showing rabbits dying and showing that they got chemical weapons to kill the rabbits. And they're saying that unbelievers will die like rabbits.
Yes, I think what's going on is all sides in the Syrian conflict are trying to bend our heads by using propaganda techniques. It's quite transparent that NATO is not prepared to seriously negotiate around this crisis. Assad isn't going to go. He's got nowhere to go, nor have the Kurds, who have been fighting with the Free Syrian Army this week, I understand, nor have the Christian minority in Syria, nor have the Alawite minority, who are a kind of Shiite. And many of the Free Syrian Army rebel groups are Sunni groups, some more extreme than others. This is not a black and white conflict. The Russians have been saying this all along. What we've got to do is get all reasonable people round a table, including the current government, and try and come up with a solution, including, for example, a ceasefire. What's the matter with a ceasefire? Well, I'll tell you what's the matter with a ceasefire. NATO have basically blocked any kind of ceasefire from day one. And at that point, it's war all the way, isn't it? But if it is war all the way, the West has got to live with the consequences. If you go around, if British SAS forces, for example, are inside Syria and they get captured by the Syrian army, they're not going to be treated under the Geneva Convention because they shouldn't be there.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, to the one of the spots I particularly like, and that is where we hear from Press TV, because Press TV have been banned by the official broadcasting regulator Ofcom in Britain after rather actual trivial inaccuracies, if you compare them to the sorts of inaccuracies that were being broadcast on the BBC, on ITN, and all the other Sky, all the other broadcasters to do with weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Anyway, so let's hear from them now, and we hear from Gordon Duff, who's the editor of Veterans Today, about Afghanistan and Pakistan.
We're dealing with the part of the world where every male over 10 years old owns a weapon. Any person with a weapon is considered a militant. Anyone that's killed either falls into the category of militant or collateral damage. The real issues, the justice of war, the respect for Pakistan's sovereignty, are never brought up. Now, Pakistan will be looking at a new government next year. It is very likely that Imran Khan will be the leader of Pakistan, and he has sworn to bring an end to all strikes across the border. Then we're going to be dealing with the issue, and he will enforce it. The issue we'll have is Afghanistan. The insanity of claiming that everyone with a gun, every tribal member, every Pashtun in Pakistan, every person that has refused to join the narcotic republic that the United States has built there is a militant. If one looks at this quite honestly, there is no reason for American involvement in Pakistan other than to protect an $80 billion drug empire. That's what we're really doing. It's all that we've done there. We control none of the country. We have built no police force. We have built no army. We have no consensus government. We have no policies. We found no weapons of mass destruction. We found no members of Al-Qaeda. We certainly didn't find the people responsible for 9/11, as they were never there, as any person of common sense knows. No, we're there for another reason. We're there to make money, we're there to steal, and we're there to grow opium, process it into heroin, and to distribute it around the world. Nothing right. else.
That was Gordon Duff there speaking on the band by Ofcom Press TV, where you can find it online, of course, on YouTube / Press TV, and also on PressTV.ir for Iran. Martin, Gordon Duff is saying there, essentially, he's saying that at the moment there is no respect at all for Pakistani sovereignty. So do you think what he's saying is correct, that if Imran Khan takes over next year, that maybe there will be a bit of a debacle between the Pakistani government and the US, and they'll say, no, you can't do your drones around here anymore?
Well, the existing Pakistani government, which is an elected government, and of course democracy is rather fragile in Pakistan because of the power of the army, but the elected government has been saying for years, will you please stop coming across the border and killing our citizens, because it's illegal. And of course it is illegal. And I would like to say to all of those people sitting in Nevada working those drones which are killing people in Pakistan, you are doing an illegal act. You're killing what are classified as 98% innocent people. You know what's going to happen to you? You're going to prison. And don't think that your commanding officers are going to protect you when we come knocking on the door. All of those that have been involved in illegal acts assassinating civilians in Pakistan, you are committing an illegal act, and you will be taken to The Hague, and you will be put in prison.
Okay, from Pakistan to Afghanistan, he was talking about there. Everyone over 12 has a gun, pretty much, and everyone is a militant.
Well, yes, the situation has been very destabilised there for many years, going back to the 80s when the heroin trade was used to finance the Mujahideen trying to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. And, of course, Wali Karzai's government have up to their necks in drug dealing. They didn't win the election. They stuffed the ballot boxes. Wali Karzai's brother was on the CIA payroll, but at the same time the biggest drug dealer in Afghanistan. And, of course, the CIA has been involved in drug dealing in Vietnam, been involved in drug dealing in China, but with the nationalists in the 40s. This is all a big mess, and the fact of the matter is that we are now basically going to go down the drain. The banking system is very vulnerable, and the war is basically going to happen.
Okay, also an $80 billion drug empire is what he says there. Can we say that this is part of the drug empire, which is supplying the sort of drugs that we were just hearing about from Alan Goddard, the kind of things which are causing addiction here right on our streets here in Bristol?
Well, in the 1980s, when heroin addiction rocketed in Britain and in Bristol, that was funding the war in Afghanistan, which our leaders of the time, Margaret Thatcher, were cheering on the Mujahideen as they killed Russian soldiers and got them addicted to heroin. At the same time, that was hitting back on our own streets. It was the heroin addicts of Bristol that financed the liberation of Afghanistan in the first place, to get rid of the evil Russian Empire. And this has been going on for decades.
Okay, so ultimately this business of Pakistani sovereignty, why is it the Pakistani government can't just say to the Americans, no, you cannot use your drones over our territory?
Because the United States is a superpower and Pakistan is a relatively vulnerable country, largely depends on the US to fund its army, for example. But I think the possibility of a wider war here is enormous. And we're talking about a war that will run all the way from Somalia to the borders of China. And, of course, may also come to the streets of this country.
OK, thanks, Martin. And we're going to pick up now where we left off last week on Somalia and hear from Omar Farouk Osman. He's the president of the Federation of African Journalists.
My name is Omar Farouk Osman. I'm the Secretary General of the National Union of Somali Journalists. I happen to be the president of the Federation of African Journalists, which is a conglomerate of unions of journalists from the African continent. We are now 44 African countries representing 80,000 journalists.
Tell us from your overview, what is the state of play with journalism across the continent?
The journalism profession is now the riskiest profession to be practiced in Africa, because journalism has been criminalized by all forces who do not want to hear or see uncomfortable truth, and they want to suppress it. Journalists are also being killed and targeted because of reporting of something that one does not like to be reported. And what happened is more than that. is the way the life of the journalist is being given, you know, hard time in terms of promoting press freedom, in terms of giving voice to the voiceless people, to the minorities, to the women, to the children, and then they are being suppressed because of that.
Can you give us an idea of some of the stories which journalists have been reporting in different countries that have actually led to them being killed?
His stories that relate to the human rights violations, crimes against humanity, rape, you know, violence against women, corruption, you know, internal wranglings of government officials, you know, public office misuse, public resources misuse. These have been issues that are mindful for journalists, and if you touch them, then you fear for your life because no one is going to protect you.
What about countries, though? Which are the, could we say, the worst countries in on the continent?
Somalia is the worst country for journalists in the continent, and I say that because it is the deadliest country for journalists in 4 years in a row, because this year alone 15 journalists were killed so far. Which makes, you know, extremely understandable the way the violence and the killing of journalists has increased. What is also shocking is the way that Eritrean journalists are being detained, which makes Eritrea the worst jailer of journalists in Africa, with 32 journalists behind the bars incommunicado.
Well, that's a bit worrying, but I mean, I suppose it's better to be jailed than it is to be killed. Well, give us an idea of maybe in Somalia, one or two of the stories that have led to journalists being killed there, because it's nice to get specific, to say, well, this specific story, that they reported this, and then not long after this, they were killed.
One of the histories that was quite interesting was because journalists were being tried to be forced to be, you know, in neutral or give a voice to the militant extremists. And if you try to be neutral, to be independent, then those who try it have been killed because they were said, look, you are traitors. You do not want to defend your country, your religion. Your country is under attack, your religion is under attack, and you do not want to report it.
Now tell us about these militant extremists. Who are they?
Well, these are Al-Shabaab extremists group, which are well known, and they are affiliated to Al-Qaeda, and they are committed, you know, to impose, you know, strict Islamic rule in Somalia. But the people do not want them. People see them like a threat. People see them like people who want to undermine the values and the culture of the Somali society. So that's why the media is very hostile, even because of its profession, because it wants to report independently, because it wants to tell the violations that this you know, extremist terrorist group are committing. Therefore, when they report that, then the militias of Al-Shabaab come and kill journalists. That is why they kill it. The other well-known case is journalists who were investigating corruption at the Mogadishu seaport. When they have exposed the corruption of the seaport, then they were killed for that.
So what kind of corruption is that? Just simply money being taken for ships as they come in and out?
Yes, yes. And that is the problem. When that has been reported by the media, then journalists were paid through the politics.
So it does imply that you've got a sort of mafia operating in your country.
We have a mafia. We have a group of criminalist groups, so like a mafia business, who if you go to them and report about them, then they shoot you, they attack you, and they kill you with impunity. And they even call you and they tell you, look, you know, do you know that I can kill you, you know, by paying $50? So you need to be very careful. And which means they're 30 British pound, you know, then, you know, they kill you with that simple way. And that's what makes journalists nervous. Look, do I report this very important history? If I report it and if I leak it, then I will have a problem.
Is there any way that journalists can report these things anonymously without actually putting their name to a story? That may be a way, possibly, of getting away from, you know, being able to report things without being killed.
Well, when you are reporting in a radio station and your voice will be heard, so it would be very difficult for you to hide, you know, who you are, your identity. It would be very difficult. That makes you difficult for you to report on such kind of issues. But if a journalist would like, you know, to report it anonymously, he or she would prefer that, but that is not possible.
One of the famous stories to do with Somalia is to do with these pirates. Can you tell us if this is real? Because in the past we had pirates that were supposedly independent. It turned out later that they were being run by the British Crown.
Well, these allegations have been there, and when you see the issue of piracy, we don't think that a piracy issue is a local issue. It is not a national issue. It's an international issue. And it has international context. And when you see it, the way the money is transacted for these pirates, it is not, they are not, the money is not taken in Somalia. The money is taken outside Somalia. So there are a set of connections concerning this matter, which is, you know, making the issue an international issue, an international affair, where people are doing this because of they wanted to do other hidden agenda. So for us, we believe that is a way to attract to global attention and to bring this issue on the table. But it's not a Somali issue alone. Is not a problem which is only for the Somalis to handle it. It is a problem that the international community has to stand up, because it has international actors playing part of it.
That was Omar Farouk Osman from the Federation, in fact, President of Federation of African Journalists, also the Chief of the Somali Journalists Union. Quite privileged to have a chat with him. Martin Summers, quite a lot to talk about from that. But, I mean, ultimately, this whole business of the pirates, he's saying there, actually, it's not a Somali problem, it's actually an international problem.
Well, as the colleague last week was pointing out, that basically when the state broke down in Somalia, basically people came and dumped all sorts of hazardous waste. They took all the fish out of the sea, sort of trawlers arrived taking the fish. So the pirates are a response to the lack of opportunities for people in that coastal region of Somalia. And Somalia, of course, is a geopolitical football. And they've always been at the sharp end of other people's wars.
Time to sign off now, but that's just the start of your Friday night talk radio extravaganza, coming up next to the all live typical topical Afro tropical show. My name's Tony Gosling. The website thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and to our archives. You can follow my Twitter feed in between shows on @ Tony Gosling. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a nurse who took a prank call at the hospital caring for the pregnant Duchess of Cambridge has been found dead. It's thought Jacintha Saldana committed suicide days after Australian radio DJs gleaned information about Kate's condition. John Lofthouse, the chief executive of the King Edward VII in London, is paying tribute.
It is with deep sadness that I can confirm the tragic death of a member of our nursing staff. Jacintha has worked at the King Edward VII Hospital for more than 4 years. Our thoughts and deepest sympathies are with her family and her friends.
The company which owns the Australian radio station at the centre of the call says the presenters behind it won't return to their show until further notice. David Cameron is backing gay weddings in churches, but the Prime Minister says religious institutions will never be forced to hold ceremonies. Joseph Musgrave.